The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Wall Street closed sharply higher on Friday as signs of peaking inflation and consumer resiliency sent investors into the Memorial Day weekend with growing optimism that the Federal Reserve will be able to tighten monetary policy without tipping the economy into a recession.
I think we're going to see a nice bear market rally. There's a lot to love about these rallies, and they can be pretty significant. I would say this, enjoy this, but all good bear market rallies end until there is visibility that fundamentals are improving. Put it simply, just enjoy this ride, the next 10%, and then batten the hatches down.
The day President Biden arrived in Asia last week, China sent 14 warplanes into Taiwan's air defense zone.
Are you willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that?
Yes, that's the commitment we made. The idea that it can be taken by force is just not appropriate. It will dislocate the entire region and be another action similar to what happened in Ukraine.
You know, Tom, I was an early believer in crypto. I remember looking into Bitcoin first when it was at $100. Mm-hmm. I did a presentation up at the Nantucket Project on crypto, how to invest in it. And I really thought that, you know, this is a viable investment vehicle. But as you know, the definition of a currency is that it's a medium of exchange, it's a store of value, it's a unit of account.
Not the last 90 days.
Not at all. And so we've learned that none of this stuff, stable coins, the whole bit, everything is suspect.
I think there's an extraordinary reality that we're facing that truly is a global food crisis. To keep the ports closed as the harvest season is now coming in Ukraine in July and August, it means a declaration of war on global food security.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, after 8 weeks of decline, the markets are in rally mode this week as all indexes gain ground. Energy prices remain high as the administration's policies are driving oil prices higher, along with low inventories and increased demand. The good news this week is that inflation decelerated slightly in May, rising 6.3% versus last month's rise of 6.6%. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Tom McClellan joins me at the top of the hour. Tom sees the current rally as a bear market rally from extreme oversold conditions, but he believes this isn't a market bottom. Following Tom is a special interview with Peter Zion as we discuss his new book, The End of the World is Just the Beginning, Mapping the Collapse of Globalization. It's a dark message you're going to want to listen to. The full-length interview of an hour will be heard on FS Insider. But before we do that, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
An overdue rally on an oversold market. This week, the bulls were finally able to bounce back. This week marks the end of an 8-week losing streak for the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which has only been seen twice in the last 100 years. And it also breaks a 7-week losing week in the NASDAQ Composite. The Consumer Discretionary Group took the lead in the rally with energy, technology, and financials close behind. At the industry group level, the steel index and the automobile index were two of the biggest surprises to me among the strong groups. There were a few catalysts, but I think the one that played the biggest part was the Federal Open Market Committee's minutes on Wednesday, which seemed to give bulls the confidence they needed to defend the lows from last week. And with some follow-up on trading on Thursday and Friday this week to confirm a significant short-term bottom is in. Within an hour of the FOMC minutes Wednesday, the bulls were able to move the S&P 500 back up to 4,000 after testing lows of 3,800 earlier in the week on options expiration last Friday. The bulls were encouraged by the fact that the Fed officials want to move quickly towards a neutral rate to curb inflation, and by moving quickly towards this target, it could allow the Fed to pause its rate hikes later in the year to see the effects of its tightening policy. It's anybody's best guess at this point whether 2.5 is the neutral rate or whether that will be high enough to even curb inflation, but it was just what the doctor ordered for the ailing bulls. Interestingly, The two-year Treasury, sensitive to the Fed's plans, didn't move a pinch and hugged that 2.5% for most of the day after the news. Another major catalyst this week was ongoing earnings calls from retailers, Macy's, Dollar Tree stores, and Williams-Sonoma on Thursday that helped carry the torch from Wednesday's rally. These companies gave better-than-expected guidance, helping to negate some of the bearish sentiment felt last week from Target and Ross stores, as well as from Snap, Best Buy, and Abercrombie & Fitch Tuesday. Additionally, the Southwest Airlines and JetBlue gave upward second-quarter guidance that complemented the news from the retailers on Thursday. That good cheer also spilled into NVIDIA's post-earnings reaction. Despite the company issuing disappointing second-quarter revenue guidance after the close Wednesday, investors were feeling hopeful on the news Shanghai will end its lockdowns in Shanghai next week and helped close the stock higher Thursday up 5.2% after the stock was initially down pre-market about 5.5%. These two factors, the Fed's minutes as well as the positive reaction on retail earnings, were the primary drivers this week to the rally. The personal income and inflation data from the core PCE price index Friday sealed the deal on the rally. Income increased 0.4% in April, while personal spending rose 0.9%. The price index, the key component, was up 0.2%, while the core, which is without energy and food, was up 0.3% as expected. The key in the report was a moderation in the year-over-year increase for the price index, which is yet another inflation indicator to come out that supports the idea that inflation may have peaked. The core PCE price index was up 4.9% year-over-year versus 5.2% in March. My feeling, though, with summer here and energy prices expected to remain elevated during the demand months, I expect with all the news on travel from airlines and reports from, for example, Target last week on strong luggage demand, energy will continue to keep inflation high for now. In other news this week, the ECB's President Lagarde dropped the idea that their negative rate policy will end in the third quarter, which helped to rally the euro and cause our treasury prices to drop. The US dollar fell 1% on the news as well. On the economic front, besides the income spending and price index report Friday, new home sales decreased 16.6% in April, which has highlighted the affordability issues with a big jump in mortgage rates. Pending home sales were also down 3.9% in May, following a 1.6% decline in March. Finally, the University of Michigan's consumer sentiment report on Friday showed sentiment fell to 58.4 from 59.1 last month, with negative views on buying conditions for houses and durables, as well as a negative outlook on the economy. To sum up the week, there were strong reactions here to the notion the Fed may pause its rates hikes later this year, in addition to positive retailer and airline news that helped to end some long-lasting losing streaks in stocks. Up next, this week's guest technician is Tom McClellan.
Richard Booksaber is the co-founder and head of Risk at Fabric, which provides risk management applications for wealth managers. Prior to Fabric, he worked with Bridgewater, Salomon, and the U.S. Treasury in the aftermath of the financial crisis.
Tether has been penalized by the CFTC. It has no transparency into what reserves it holds. It's pretty clear that its reserves are not sufficient. You don't even know what it's holding in reserve, although from people that I've talked to who are somewhat knowledgeable in it, insofar as they have certificates of deposit as the basis for reserves, not only is it inadequate, but some of them are in markets that are very risky. So this is a case where things are not regulated. They have no serious auditing. They have an auditor, but not one that I think anybody would trust. So they're kind of the poster child for one component that's problematic with crypto. That's not regulated, and that it's a little bit of Wild West. But the more fundamental issue with Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies is simply you don't need them as a store of value. You don't need them as a medium of exchange. They actually don't provide anonymity. And insofar as they do, that's problematic.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today
at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Investors may be getting a bit of a reprieve. At least the stock market stopped going down, and we've seen some upturns. Is this permanent or just a dead cat bounce? Let's find out. Joining us on the program from McClellan Oscillator is Tom McClellan. Tom, you sent us a couple charts, which we're going to post on our website. The first one is investors intelligence. Tell us what this chart is telling you at the moment.
Well, Investors Intelligence is a newsletter. It's a survey of investment advisors and newsletter writers as a means of gauging sentiment. And you would think that professional investment advisors and newsletter writers would be really expert at identifying what the market is going to do. But instead, we are a good contrary indication. And what the latest data from the Investors Intelligence survey shows is that bears are at a big number. A very large percentage of the company surveys are saying that they are bearish. And what I did in this chart is I plotted that on an inverted scale to better correlate with what stock prices do. Not surprisingly, when the stock market goes down, it makes more people get bearish. When the stock market goes up, everybody gets bullish because they think they're genius and it's a wonderful time. What we have seen in the bearish percentage is a low enough reading to mark a bottom if the market wants to. It was equivalent to what we saw at the COVID crash low in April 2020, equivalent to what we saw back in early 2016. All those were really good lows. So the market is overstretched and people are pessimistic. So that means that the market deserves to bounce. Doesn't mean it has to, but it deserves to. And generally speaking, a condition like that is usually worth at least a temporary bounce.
And Tom, do you follow things like put to call ratio? How does this compare? Because I know the premiums on puts really got high.
I do follow that. And the interesting phenomenon that's going on right now, I didn't prepare a chart of this, but the overall put call ratio for all products has been showing us nice kind of bear market bottom extreme readings, meaning that the put traders and the call traders are showing an extreme of bearish sentiment. We're not seeing that in the equity only options, which is fascinating. I don't have a really good explanation other than that the normal participants who would be trading equity options, they may have taken their ball and moved to another arena. When we have 2 and 3 times leveraged ETFs and other products, and they can hedge their portfolio risk or make an outright bet in some other ways. And so we may be seeing a change in market participation from how it used to work. I'm not sure we can make that call yet, but it's a fascinating bit of history to be watch unfolding. But when we look at the overall numbers, yes, we've seen a bottom-worthy reading in the put call data that were for all issues on the CBOE.
Now, you have something, it's called the summation index. What is that saying?
Well, this is one of the indicators that my parents created back in 1969. They created the McClellan Oscillator, which was the difference between 2 exponential moving averages of the daily advanced decline difference. And my mother, being the math major, knew that, if you integrate the area underneath the curve, then that could be useful also. And so they created a second indicator, the summation index, that sums every daily McClellan Oscillator reading. And it gives you a little bit more of an intermediate term picture of what the market is doing. In this case, the chart I sent you is a ratio adjusted summation index. There's one additional step that's involved with it where we adjust for the changing number of issues over time because there are IPOs or there are mergers and delistings, lots of different ways that the number of issues can change, and that affects the amplitude. So we factor that out. And what it's showing us is, yes, we've had quite a nice sell-off, and the breadth numbers have been ugly during the sell-off, ugly enough to produce an oversold reading on the ratio-adjusted summation index. And now we also have an upturn As breath numbers have started to turn positive, we've seen an upturn in that indicator from that oversold reading, which is an encouraging sign. It's not a guarantee of anything because an upturn like this can fail. But for now, it's a bullish sign. And I'm bullish for the moment, looking for this bounce to go as far as the market wants to let it go. It hasn't yet told us whether it's going to be just a bounce or the start of a new uptrend. And I'm a little bit agnostic on that point. It's probably going to just turn into a bounce that fails at some point, probably a couple of weeks from now. But I stand ready to have the evidence convince me otherwise.
I want to go to look at interest rates for a moment. It's hard to believe that probably less than a month ago, the 10-year Treasury got up to 3.12. On the day you and I are speaking, it's down to 2.75. Where do you see interest rates going from here?
Well, surprisingly, I'm seeing interest rates falling from here. We still have 8.5% inflation rates, if you believe the CPI numbers. So arguably, interest rates should be a lot higher than they are. They would deserve to be a lot higher if we're going to have inflation rates that high. But what the bond market and the gold market are telling us is that those inflation rates are probably not going to stick around for that long. And I'm expecting long-term interest rates, long-term treasury interest rates, to trend downward for most of the rest of 2022. What the third chart that I sent you shows a really fun relationship that I discovered several years ago. If you look at the movements of the price of gold, those same movements show up about 20 and a half months later in the long-term interest rates. In this case, I'm using the Treasury Yield Index, which is the yield to maturity on the most recently issued 30-year Treasury bond. And the key trick in this chart is I've shifted the plot of gold prices forward by 20 and a half months to align the patterns and show us how the same dance steps that we saw in gold prices are getting repeated in interest rates. Not perfectly, but pretty darn well. And gold prices peaked in August of 2020. So we're now 21 months after that peak and into the period where we should be seeing interest rates echo the decline in gold prices lasting until late 2022. Then we all know that gold rebounded from its low and got back up above 2000. So we'll get to have the echo of that at some point later. But for now, bond investors should be looking for a rise in prices as the yields fall going into late 2022.
All right, let's move over to the commodity side, and let's talk about two in particular. Gold, as you were just speaking about, where you see gold going, and more importantly, what about oil? On the day you and I are speaking, we're looking at, close to 110? So oil is not, doesn't seem that it wants to go down.
And it should want to go down because the same leading indication that gives us indications about interest rates from gold, that same leading indication also works for oil prices with a slightly different lag time. It's about 19 and a half months for oil prices as they replicate the movements of gold. So what we should be seeing as a downtrend in oil prices right now. But what we're actually seeing because of what's going on in Ukraine and Russia and around the world is oil prices are hanging around at a high level longer than they should. That can happen sometimes when geopolitics puts a thumb on the scale. What I expect to happen is eventually the geopolitics is going to get sorted out and oil is going to realize it's hung around too high for too long and it's going to scurry back downward to get back on track with what gold's message says it should be doing. But it's not doing that today. Gold prices are acting nice and strong. We've had what I believe is the arrival of the 13 and a half month cycle low in gold prices. It came a little bit early, about a month early, which is not too unusual for a 13 and a half month cycle. And we've had a nice upturn. We've also had a pretty extreme sentiment reading in both the commitment traders data and in the behavior of the gold ETF investors shunning, wanting to own GLD and IAU. They've been fleeing out of those. And that's a sign that everybody hates gold. Nobody wants to own it. And when you get everybody hating gold, that's a good sign of a bottom. We've had that indication come, and we've had the upturn from that indication, and gold's just consolidating today a little bit, but I think there's going to be more up movement for gold.
Tom, how would you characterize this market to markets that we've seen in the past? I mean, you know, we're taking a look at Treasury bond yields at 2.8%. We've got inflation running at 8%. So, you know, you're behind inflation by 5 percentage points, the highest inflation we've seen almost in 4 decades, and yet gold is kind of struggled in here. About the only commodity that's really done well besides, let's say, copper has been oil. So what's your take on this market to, let's say, markets you've studied in the past?
Well, this is not going to be a fun time this whole decade for the buy and hold investor. We have seen the Fed overstimulate the market, trying to keep the market higher for various reasons at various times. We had additional stimulation in the Trump years from lower tax rates, and that's been corrected. So now we have tax rates are coming off of overstimulation, and the Fed is coming off of overstimulation all at the same time. I liken it to there's a term in gardening called hydroponics, and that's a science of gardening done at an industrial scale where you don't even use actual soil. You just have the roots of the plants and a slurry of water and fertilizer and nutrients that it needs. And you can get really, really great crop yields using hydroponic gardening as long as you keep exactly the right nutrients flowing in great quantities all the time. But if you take a plant that is used to operating in a hydroponic environment and then you try to switch it to growing an organic garden in your backyard, it's not going to do as well because it was used to doing great on the hydroponics, but it's not going to do as well under an organic situation. The Fed is now trying to yank away all that nutrients and stimulus and try to switch to an organic growth model for the economy. And there's going to be some turmoil as the economy gets used to that. In addition, we also have total federal taxation is now up above 20% of GDP. They're taking a huge tax bite, meaning that we're removing a bunch of the money out of the economy that could be used to do things like buy stuff or lift stock prices, because it's going to pay pretty high tax rates that the federal government is doing. Since the 1930s, every time that federal taxes gets up above 18% of GDP, we get a recession every time. Well, we're up above 20% now, and it's not a sustainable level. And pretty soon, Congress is going to start realizing that and start to feel the pain. Voters are going to start to realize that and probably change up the components of Congress. But that's going to be a long process, a painful process. And it's not going to be a pleasant time for investors because all that liquidity the Fed was supplying and the Treasury was supplying is now being yanked away. And the market's going to have to try to stay aloft with less liquidity, which is a really tough thing for it to do.
Tom, I want to go back to a comment you made that this is going to be a rough decade for investors, which is exactly what we're seeing. Why, in your perspective, is it going to be a rough decade?
Lots of reasons. A big part is demographics. I'm in the baby boom generation, and there's a bunch of us, and we all want to retire and live in a comfortable manner that we've been led to believe is going to be possible for us. However, when all of us try to fit through the door at the same time into retirement and remove ourselves from the workforce and start to sell off our stock portfolios to the generations coming behind us, and also we want to sell them our McMansions and all and live a comfortable life, we start to run into a numerical problem where there are not enough Gen X, Y, and Zers to support us in the manner to which we've become accustomed. So we're going to have a difficult time dealing with demographic shift as all the boomers retire and have lower workforce participation rates. At least we're starting to see as the 8% inflation is taking hold that some people who looked at the COVID situation said, now's time to retire. They're realizing, oh, 8% inflation, I may not have enough money to retire. I may need to start migrating back to the workforce. So we may see some of us boomers sticking around in the workforce for a little bit longer. We also know that the movements of oil prices tend to show up about 10 years later in the movements of the stock market. And oil prices have been chopping sideways since the peak in about 2011. And they stayed sideways to downward all through the 2010s. So that means that stock prices in the 2020s get to echo that and chop sideways. It's not a bad time to be a trader when you've got a sideways market because you get lots of opportunities to buy low and sell high repeatedly. It's a terrible time to be a buy and hold investor where you plunk your money down and just keep waiting and 8% returns keep rolling in year after year. This is not going to be that decade. So if you can learn to trade frequently and jump in and out and buy low and sell high and do it over and over again, you can have a great time. But if you're expecting that how it worked in the 2010s is going to keep working, you're going to get a less than fun realization as the years go by. I wish I had better news, but that's the news I have.
Well, you know, you take a look at it, and who would have thought, Tom, people that are retired, it was great when the stock market went up for almost every year for a decade. But now that we're pulling back and we're going to be dealing with choppier markets and probably lower interest rates. I can remember, Tom, back in the year 2000, I could have got 7 and 8% yields in fairly safe investments. Those days are gone.
Yeah, they're not giving those out at the bank anymore, even though people want them. And even more people are switching out of their growth investments in the stock market to their retirement high yield investments. The other thing that interest rates are going to do is they're going to raise the cost for the U.S. government to pay the interest on its $30 trillion debt. Eventually, some people in power are going to start to realize that's a bad thing and that we should do something about it. And they're going to be overdue in coming to that realization that $30 trillion in debt is just criminally insane and just horrible malpractice of our politicians. And as they realize that and as they take steps to address that, it will be painful and not very fun, because when you're deficit spending, that's another source of stimulus to push the stock market up. When you are having a budget surplus like we had briefly in the year 2000, that is horribly non-stimulative to the stock market. And so it takes a bunch of money out of the economy and the banking system that could otherwise lift prices. And it puts it to work doing something that should have happened a long time ago, paying off the debt that we've run up. There's no good and easy and pleasant way to do that.
So in the meantime, Tom, given your indicators, we should get a bounce here in the stock market that maybe gives investors a chance to either take some gains and get out or maybe do some trading.
Yes, that's what I'm expecting, a bounce, not a great new uptrend. When you turn on the financial news on your television and you hear them saying that it's not just a bounce, this is a new uptrend, that's when you'll know that the bounce is just about done. When you hear it declared and announced on financial TV that this is the start of a new uptrend, then you'll know that the bounce is about over. Right now, everybody's denying it and saying, oh, it's just a bounce. And when you see that sentiment switch in the commentators, you'll know that the moment is upon us. But for now, it's a strong looking bounce. We have the McClellan oscillator that my parents created. It's all the way up above plus 200, the highest reading. I got to look back. It's highest reading since I think just after the COVID crash, which can be a sign of strong initiation, but you need follow on buying for many days with strong breath to say it's something other than just a bounce. And we don't have that evidence yet.
So at least from your perch, it's looking more like a bounce. Tom, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow all the work that you do, tell them how they can do so.
Well, our company is McClellan Financial Publications. Our website is mcoscillator.com. That's a contraction of the McClellan oscillator indicator that my parents created, mcoscillator.com. You can go there and we have a big learning center with lots of free articles. You can learn more about all the indicators we use. If you want the good stuff, we have a twice monthly newsletter. It's 220 a year, and a daily edition that's 660 a year. There's other pricing options if you want the quarterly or the combination product, but go take a look. There's free sample issues of both of those available for download to take a look and see if it's something you want to give a try to.
All right. Well, listen, Tom, as always, pleasure having you on the program, and hope to talk to you again.
How do you collect emissions data from every company on the globe and then use that information to price their impact on the climate? The answer to that question is satellites, thousands of them, scanning nearly every part of the planet 24/7 and collecting that info in an automated fashion every day in near real time. FS Insider discusses how the space race is enabling another race to survey and collect data on companies, industries, and entire countries for a wide range of applications, most notably when it comes to global climate surveillance data and reporting.
So what we've been seeing the last couple of years, and it's really the last decade in the geospatial data world, is just a proliferation and explosion of data becoming available, and particularly satellite-based Earth observation data, which is, you know, super relevant because it tells you about the state of the planet and really allows you to create global data sets about what's happening, what's changing anywhere, any point on the earth over multiple points in time.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Coming up next, we are going to play the first half of an hour-long interview with the notable geopolitical strategist Peter Zeihan that aired this week on FS Insider. Jim and Peter discuss his latest book set to be released next month titled The End of the World is Just the Beginning, Mapping the Collapse of Globalization. Put on your seatbelts and get prepared for some pretty big forecasts that Peter is making. Though we are going to play a good 30 minutes of the discussion, this is only half of the full interview that aired on FS Insider. So as always, be sure to visit Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button to gain full access to all of our premium content airing during the week. Lastly, don't forget to pre-order Peter's book on Amazon. We'll have a link where this interview is located on our site. And as you'll hear today, if only half of what he says is true, there are some major changes ahead for the world that we all may want to prepare for.
Joining me on the program is geopolitical strategist and best-selling author Peter Zeihan. We're here to talk about his new book, The End of the World is Just the Beginning, Mapping the Collapse of Globalization. Peter, I want to read something from the introduction of your book. You said, our world has gotten cheaper, better, and faster. But you point out this is artificial. It was a perfect moment in time, and it is now passing. Instead of cheap, better, and faster, we're transitioning to a world that's pricier, worse, and slower because the world is breaking apart. Let's begin with the opening of your book.
Well, that's a cheery place to start. What I do is I cover two major trends, deglobalization and depopulation. The globalized era that we're familiar with that brought us international finance and energy and technology, it was only made possible because the United States wanted a security paradigm to fight the Soviets during the Cold War. And we invited everyone to join, and we told everyone that we would protect all their shipping at all times to all places and open all markets if in exchange they would side with us against the Soviets. And it worked, and that's what created globalization. But what people forget is that globalization was a bribe. And with the Soviet Union gone, the strength of the American commitment to that system went with it. And in the next seven presidential elections, we went with the guy who was less of a globalist. And that includes the shift from Trump to Biden. So that era is over. And then there's depopulation. When the world became safe because of globalization, everyone was able to move into more value-added work. So it was off the farm and into town to take manufacturing and services jobs. Well, when you live on a farm, you have a lot of kids because they're free labor. But when you live in a condo in Manhattan, you have very few kids because of the cost of raising them, and there's no economic payout until you're near retirement, and that's only if they take care of you. So in a very short period of time, people go from having five or six kids to one or none. You play that out on a global stage, and we are at the beginning of a massive population bust. In most of the advanced world, we've already aged past the point of having enough young people to be consumers or workers. And in large portions of the advanced world, we're on the verge of a mass retirement wave without replacement generations down the line. Well, if you don't have those people, you don't have the investment that comes from it. You don't have the consumption that comes from it. You don't have the workers that come from it. So the very foundation of every economic model we have, whether it's capitalism or socialism or fascism, just doesn't work in an era of population busts. And we are well past the point of no return on both of those trends.
Now, in your book, you talk about this devolution. You talk about the geography of success. It's not immutable. A deglobalization world is going to have a different economic geography. But one of the positive things, which is a theme through many of your books, the U.S. largely escapes the carnage to come. Let's talk about that.
So think about what makes a modern iPhone possible. You have copper from Chile. You've got wiring that's done in Malaysia. You've got computer chips that are designed in the United States and fabricated in Taiwan. You have a case that's probably made in China. You have a camera system from Japan, and so on and so on. The economy of the whole, of the entire single global network, enables countries at different labor points, at different price points, at different skill sets to all collaborate on a single supply chain to make an end product. And whenever you break a system apart into so many different constituent pieces, each individual step of that process is able to maximize their economic utility and performance. Those economies of scale, that geography of success, is one of the whole. But if you start breaking that down for reasons cultural or moral or economic or trade or labor, you have access to fewer and fewer places to manufacture those inputs. So if, for example, the United States was just to pull up the drawbridge and go home, a lot of the electronics manufacturing that happens in East and Southeast Asia would no longer be accessible. We would have to rebuild that ourselves. And the same goes the other direction. If the Chinese, for various reasons, like say COVID lockdowns, falls out of the network, that would all need to be relocated. And when you have fewer producers in fewer places, the costs of all those components go up, and the chances for supply mismatches, at least in the short run, explodes. What makes the United States unique is that while we do have a generation that is retiring that is large, the boomers, we actually have a replacement generation coming up, or one of the few exceptions, the millennials. And so the United States still has the capacity to have the investment, the consumption, the design, and the production all more or less in one place, particularly when you partner with Mexico. So it's one third of global consumption is in North America. That's certainly less of an economies of scale than the global whole, but there's no other part of the planet that has that sort of advantage. And what we're seeing in the world of manufacturing and really everything else is when you start compartmentalizing different pieces of the world, size matters. And the North American continent is already well set up demographically, legally, politically, culturally, and financially for what is coming. And if the United States is no longer holding up the ceiling for everywhere else is, for the most part, in a lot of trouble.
Let's talk about these transitions that we've seen. We've gone from farming to the Industrial Revolution to the high-tech revolution. We're trying to move, Peter, to what people are calling the Green Revolution. Let's talk about this transition. It's more likely to take longer and maybe turn out much different than we think.
Well, let's start with the positive side. There are a number of parts of the world that have great wind potential and great solar potential. The problem is that that's not everywhere. That's only in a very small sliver of the Earth's surface, probably less than about, it depends on where you draw the line, but about 10% of the total. A lot of those zones are in places that people don't live. So think the central outback, think Central Asia, think North Africa. However, in the United States Southwest, roughly going from Los Angeles to Dallas-Fort Worth, that's one of the best solar zones in the world. And the American Great Plains are one of the best wind zones in the world. And there are sufficient population centers in or adjacent to those zones that the United States can reasonably use solar and wind for a significant percentage of its energy production without too many changes to the grid. But in most places, the closest major wind or solar zones is a continent away. So the Europeans would have to go into the Sahara. The Chinese would have to go into the outback. And that's just not feasible with today's technology. There's also the same problem of the whole versus the problem of the many when you look at the components that are necessary to make these systems to work. We understand the agony of oil supply chains. You have to deal with Venezuela and Iran and Iraq and Russia. But if you want to go into wind and solar in a big way, you need to replace the oil supply chain with a supply chain in order to make the turbines and the panels. And that means you need Canada and Mexico and Brazil and Chile and Bolivia and Argentina and Italy and Romania and China and Australia and Malaysia and Indonesia and Sri Lanka and Kenya and Ethiopia and South Africa and, oh yes, still Russia. The complexity of the supply chains to build out today's green tech is an order of magnitude more complex than what exists for oil. So we're in this weird situation where we're moving away from the globalized system, and we'd like to have energy self-sufficiency. And by we, I mean every individual country. But it can't be done without the global system. And in the short term, we know we can't have globally available, inexpensive fossil fuel energy without Russia. But looking forward, we also can't do the green transition without Russia.
In one of the things you talk about, and this once again gets back to the positive side on the U.S., in your previous book, The Accidental Superpower, you talk about the U.S. having the most powerful river and land power in the history of the planet. Let's talk about that.
Sure. So it really comes down to transport. Lugging things from A to B is kind of a bitch, but if you float it, it's about 1/12 the cost of moving it by a semi. The Greater Mississippi System of the U.S. has more miles of navigable waterway than the internal totals of the rest of the world combined. And if you add in secondary American rivers or the intracoastal or maybe the Great Lakes Network, you're talking about the U.S. by itself having almost double that of everyone else. The ability to float things is in many ways the way you make transport into an issue of global power. And the United States used that aggressively in its first 150 years of existence. In addition, the United States' greater Midwest region is the best agricultural zone in the world. Not only is it large, not only is it contiguous, not only does it roughly overlap that river network, it also gets its moisture from two different atmospheric systems, the jet stream, which flows west to east, and then moisture from the Gulf that comes up north roughly into the heart of the Midwestern system. So it is very rare for the Midwest for both of those systems to fail and trigger a drought. So the sort of climate problems that bedevil agriculturalists in most of the rest of the world, in the United States, that's maybe a one in decade event instead of a one in 3 years event.
So in this system that we have grown up for most of our lives, you call this a system that was brought about by the order. Explain what the order allowed, because it allowed countries to specialize in things that they were good at because they could buy the things they weren't good at from other countries because of globalization and trade. And that was made possible by the might of the U.S. military. And I live in San Diego, which is home to four of our 10 carrier battle groups. We have the Navy SEALs here. We have the Marines here. We have a sub base here. And you really get a feeling for the power of the U.S. military. Explain how that is changing now as the U.S. withdraws and the order is no longer the order.
What's the other side of the coin of globalization? When we made the world safe for civilian maritime traffic, any country that wanted to play could play in any way that they wanted to. And so countries wouldn't have to simply follow the same template. Before globalization, if you wanted your population to have food, you had to grow it yourself. If you wanted to have a manufacturing system, you had to do it yourself, and you had to protect it and not integrate with potential rivals or even countries that were friendly, because if there was a conflict, even if you weren't involved, you could see your entire supply system break down, and that would be catastrophic. Globalization did away with that lack of network, and we finally got to a situation where any country could play in any way. So take South Korea, which before globalization was one of the poorest parts of the planet. The population basically lived in subsistence farming. But when they had access to raw materials and markets the world over, they started industrializing. They started urbanizing. They started getting into value-added industries, and they went from heavy industries to medium industries like toy production to ultimately high-tech like cell phones and semiconductors. They then sell those products on the international market to purchase the things that they need, whether that's cement or copper or oil or food. Every single country in the world has gone down this road to a certain degree at different paces, starting from different points, but overall the story is the same. Well, we're now getting to do that in reverse. Whether it's because of the Ukraine war or a dust up in the Middle East or the United States going home and just not holding up the ceiling anymore, we're seeing countries being forced to fall back onto their own internal systems and lose their access to the wider world. In some countries, that's a food crisis. In some, it's an energy crisis. In some, it's manufacturer shortages. In some, it's all of the above. We're going to be seeing a lot of countries just flat out fail moving forward. And just as the industrialization process has dominated most of the last 70 years of history, the next 20 years is going to be dominated by deindustrialization as countries lose access to the networks and the resources and the markets that are necessary to make these systems work.
So in your book, you talk about the halcyon days of globalization were 1980 to 2015, and you say that period is over, and it's being brought about by the demographic collapse of birth rates, which is now gathering steam. And, you know, like anything else, Peter, it takes time to produce children, to raise children to the time they become productive adults. So this isn't something that's going to be fixed overnight. And I keep thinking of China, which everybody is saying, a lot of people are saying is the next superpower. And I want to talk about that later on. But with China's one-child policy, that's now catching up with them, just as having fewer children in Europe and elsewhere is catching up with other countries as well.
Demographics are a lot like a glacier. It doesn't matter until suddenly it's everything. And we're at the point where it's everything. We passed the point of no return in most countries when it came to demographic collapse 20 and 30 years ago. It takes a long time for a lack of children to turn into a lack of mature adults. But we're there now. China's an excellent example. And you see it both from a positive and a negative point of view. Positively, if your birth rate collapses, for the next 20 years, you see higher and higher consumption levels because you have a lot of young workers who don't have kids. They're able to put in longer hours at work, which means they earn more income, and then they spend that income on very high octane growth things like cars and vacations and condos. That just generates more economic growth than eking out a subsistence agricultural existence or buying diapers. But if you do it for another 20 years, then you're talking about having run out of people aged 40 to birth. And in that environment, they have lots and lots of capital because they're mature workers, they have decades of experience in their jobs, their incomes are high, their consumption is falling off, but the amount of money that they can throw into their investment portfolios is huge. And in those systems, you see high tax income and high standards of living and high technical capacity of the entire system, and it makes it look unstoppable. And that is the situation that China was in roughly 10 years ago. But you now have very few people aged 40 and under, which means it is now statistically impossible to sustain your population. And another 10 years on, and you're talking about a complete collapse of consumption, and a big chunk of your worker cadre is now aging into retirement, and that's where the system collapses. And that's where China is now. We now know from the bits and pieces of the 2020 Chinese census that have been released, there are going to be half as many Chinese in the year 2050 as there are now. Their aging is that terminal and that fast. And that means it is impossible for the Chinas that we know to survive this decade. The only question is, when does the collapse happen? In 2024, in 2028, in 2030? It's going to be very soon. And China is going to go out just like it came in, with a big splash.
Yeah, that was something you mentioned in your book. In 2022, you talk about China is the fastest aging society in human history. And you talk about we could see them traveling from a pre-industrial level of wealth and health to a post-industrial demographic collapse in a single lifetime.
China basically compressed six generations of industrial development into one. And so, of course, the nominal growth rate was impressive, but that also means it crushed six generations of demographic transition into one generation. And that means there is no one to carry the torch in the future.
So you talk about deglobalization doesn't mean a darker, poorer world, but something much worse. You describe that as decivilized. Explain.
It's going to be different for each country. Some countries produce excess food and then import fuel. Some produce export fuel and import manufacturers. But you've got to look at who is more integrated, who is more dependent upon inputs that come from abroad. And in those countries, you're looking at a breakdown of their manufacturing model, their input model, their consumption model. At the same time, they may be facing a demographic collapse. And the countries that face the greater challenges, we're not just talking about the power going out. We're talking about the food no longer being produced at scale. One of the early outcomes of the Ukraine war that we're all dealing with right now is we now have a global fertilizer shortage because the Russian space was responsible for something like 40% of global potash and 15% of global nitrogen and a significant amount of phosphate on top of that. And so this calendar year, we are seeing farmers the world over either using no fertilizer, less fertilizer, or crop switching to crops that don't require as many inputs. So this harvest season, this fall, we're going to see a massive shortage in global calories. We'll play that forward. It's not just Russia that's falling out of the constellation of the global economy. So too is China, the world's largest phosphate exporter. So too is a lot of the stuff in the Eastern Hemisphere. When you break down food and energy and consumption at the same time, you're talking about a systemic challenge at every level of each individual country. And the ones that were more dependent upon these imports and outputs, these imports and exports, they're not just looking at the lights going out. They're looking at a population correction as we experience agricultural demand destruction, which is a fancy technical way of saying mass famine. In those systems, whether it happens to be in China or sub-Saharan Africa or Central Asia, you're looking at a complete collapse of what it means to be able to participate in the modern world. And that means the rule of law goes away. That means the government goes away. And we're going to have to watch a lot of these places just break down into a system that we have not seen in the last two centuries, places where industrialization is simply no longer possible.
You talk about the world that we have all grown up, most boomers that are living today. We grew up in a world that got better, cheaper, faster. Just take a look at the technological inventions that we have. We have smartphones, we have iPads, technology, communication. You talk about what we've experienced as a result of industrialization moving to a technological revolution. That was an anomaly. Explain that, because a lot of people are still hoping that, you know, now the pandemic's over, despite the war in the Ukraine, we're going to go back to normal and things will be like they used to be. That's not going to happen.
Absolutely not. I mean, there's two aspects to this. You know, part of it is the globalization story, having those economies of scale, no one having to really worry about a geography of success because the Americans made this world safe for everyone. That commitment is gone. And even if you look at what the Biden administration is doing with the Europeans as regards the Ukraine war, he's trying to do the security side of globalization without the economic side. Now, that can work on a case-by-case basis, and I see no reason that there's not hope for the coalition that is backing Ukraine. But as soon as that war is over, economic issues are simply being ignored. He seems to have no interest in seeking a meaningful trade relationship with any part of the world where we don't already have a trade deal. And in fact, every single tariff that the Trump administration has levied on the wider world, Biden has doubled down on almost all of them. There's a couple of exceptions here and there that are notable, but that's the overall story. The second piece, of course, is demographics. We've had a balance for 1980 to roughly 2015 between countries with a lot of people in their 20s and 30s and countries with a lot of people in their 40s and their 50s. So we've had a good balance of importers and exporters, capital producers and capital consumers, and that's led to an ever more networked system. But 20 years later, we are all 20 years older. And the countries that were the income providers, the ones with all the people in their 40s and 50s, they're now moving into mass retirement. And the people who were the consumers, everyone in their 20s and 30s, well, they're now in their 40s and 50s, which means that we've run out of consumers and the base labor that's necessary to make the system work. We can't go back. If you want to have a lot more 30-year-olds and you start right now, you still have to wait 30 years. And there's no sign of birth rate expansions in any country of size anywhere in the world. So we are just slouching towards an ever older demographic in an environment where the economy gets broken up into ever smaller pieces. We're losing economies of scale. We're losing the skill sets, we're losing the investment capital, and we're losing the labor all at the same time. So when I talked about the Chinese compressing six generations of activity into one, in a way, the world did that on a larger scale, compressing about a century of growth into 30 years. And if we want to get back to that world, and we start right now, we need a new globalized system with a new impetus, with a new security guarantor, and at least 40 years to grow the people to make it happen.
So as you look at this, one of the things I find interesting, how will different forms of government handle this, from a capitalistic system like the U.S. to socialism or even to communism? How does this work when there's less?
Well, I'm going to try to not play favorites here. I'm obviously American and therefore capitalist by definition. But the systems that we have in place were all designed for the economic realities of the last 500 years of population growth. The whole idea is that as systems become larger and more integrated, they generate more economic activity. How you manage that is up to the political proclivities of each individual country. And in the time since the Columbus expeditions, we have settled as a species on four broad systems: socialism, capitalism, fascism, and command-driven communism. They all have their perks, they all have their drawbacks. Capitalism generally generates a lot more economic growth, but at the cost of a degree of social exclusion as you get the rich versus the poor. Command-driven communism can generate much faster results, but only if the folks that are in charge of the command system are really on the ball every single day. If they fail, you get a mix of corruption and economic dysfunction. But what all four have in common is this concept of more, that the populations are going to expand, so the economies will expand, and then you'll have more of a pie to divvy up. That's not the world we're in anymore. 500 years of economic history is being unwound right now because the populations are no longer getting bigger and the whole is no longer expanding. So we're having to struggle to divvy up pieces of a pie that is actually shrinking at the same time it's breaking apart. We don't have a single economic theory that was designed to deal with what we're facing right now.
I want to talk about probably one of the scariest things in your book. In fact, it's, as you mentioned, it's one of the things that keeps you up at night: food production and famine. Let's go there next.
So that concludes the first part of our interview with Peter Zion. Again, the full interview between Jim Poplava and Peter went an hour long in FS Insider this week. So if you'd like to listen to the full thing, go to financialsense.com and hit where it says subscribe. If you have any questions or feedback on what we discussed today, feel free to send us a message by going to financialsense.com and hitting where it says contact us. If you'd like to get in touch with us about our investment services for asset management or financial planning, you can also give us a call at 888-486-3939. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any company
companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.